the Wildlife Observer Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Brothers in Birding. I am your host, Heike James, with my homie Tony. And today we're joined by J. Drew Lanham. He is a distinguished alumni professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University, where he studies the intersections of race, place, and conservation with wild birds as a conduit for understanding. He is the poet laureate of Edgefield, South Carolina, and the author of Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature, and Sparrow Envy Poems. Nice to have you on, Drew.
Good to be here, Tyke. Good to be here, Tony. Or good to be there, or where I am.
Great to have you on.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk with y'all.
Well, one, I'm really happy you could make the time, and for me, it's great to talk to you again. I know that we've crossed paths in prior birding festivals and conferences, and it's kind of crazy to see where I was then, where we were then, and now here we are. You know, there's a weird cycle to it. Not cycle, but you know, there's a nice rhythm to it.
Yeah, I think there was certainly for a lot of us in a lot of ways, things taken for granted. And now, you know, here we are in this very peculiar set of circumstances. One of the things that I wanted to say while we take a beat was that's the... you know, I've been thinking about birds prevailing and during all of this, what I call the three plagues. And I think originally biblically there were what, seven? If I'm not mistaken, I don't know. I'm no biblical scholar, but you know, you have these three plagues that we're dealing with. So it'll be interesting to see as more people pay attention to birds. It'll be interesting to see where we come out on the other side of this with not just birding and bird watching, but bird conservation. So I'm appreciative of the forum to talk about that.
Absolutely. And actually my initial interest of birding was what propelled me into conservation. It was my, it was through this program that Tony managed. It was through meeting him and his focus and his background on birds that really, picked up my appetite for not only learning and adventure, but to see where the birds could take me. And, you know, now I'm out, you know, in a large conservation organization doing the work that, I was doing in principle when I was much younger. And, you know, I just want to say to that comment, yeah, birds can definitely take you places. And when you find that opportunity or when that opportunity finds you, it can really be an open-ended opportunity for something great.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of like a weasel on the back of a woodpecker. You know?
I love that visual.
Yeah, that is whoever caught that image has to just think about that every day of their life.
Yeah, that. Well, I guess technically, it'd be a stoat on the back of a woodpecker, you know. And David Lindo is going to kill me for that.
I was just about to say that. I'm like, we're trying to have David Lindo on eventually.
Lindo's going to slay me, man. I'm sorry, David. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no. All right.
We'll I feel like when we started this, I was a little like, I don't know what to say. This is the first time I've really spoken to anybody, not by typing, in other than my wife, in a couple of days, and things have just gotten so intense. It's just you almost feel like you have to address it. You know, it's like in the back of your mind, and you're like, "Can I make small talk? Is small talk okay?" Like, it's just
actually that's a very good point. What's your take on that, Drew?
Well, you know, wow, small talk. Is there any small
talk in 2020? What is that?
Is there any? In sort of the normal course of events, you know, the commute from the bedroom to the dining room table and then rush hour you know, to the bathroom or whatever. And everything, you know, we talk about economies of scale and the complexities thereof. You know, I talk about ecologies of scale sometimes with my students. These are psychologies of scale because, you know, all of a sudden we're compressed to home, hopefully, and doing what we should do for the virus. And, you know, we speak to family on a daily basis or maybe not. And then, you know, there are assumptions. You're in the same household with people. Do you ask, well, how are you today? You know, how was your work day? Well, you were sitting right over there in the living room while I was, you know, at my office or whatever. So the small talk is certainly the content of it has changed. But Tony, I would like to think that, man, there's so much big talk. There's no room for small talk, you know. And maybe sometimes the small talk is somewhat of a release from everything else that's sort of collapsed on us. And, you know, quite honestly, I think the small talk now sometimes is the birds or, you know, what you're getting in your backyard. Maybe it's the big talk. I noticed on eBird just, you know, how scant a lot of the reports are and have been. And that was a good sign, I think, in that people were doing what they were supposed to do. So, but there was really, you know, very, very little conversation that's small anymore. And I think that's part of, quite honestly, that what has me and, excuse me, many of my friends, the people that I talk to on Zoom or whatever other medium, we all sort of have that, not only that fluorescent ashiness that we were talking about early on, but also just this, I remember seeing pictures of combat soldiers from World War II, and they called it the 1,000-mile stare, you know. And I think people, whether maybe it's because we've been staring into small phone size screens for so long or into our computer cameras, that we just have this stare. And so I like small talk now to break things up, but that small talk has become what used to be big talk, which was, you know, so much of the stuff about birds. And maybe that's big talk too. I would like for it to remain that way, but yeah, it's different. It's different times. Have you guys thought about what you were doing this time last year?
Yes, I definitely was. This time last year, we're now in June. Mm-hmm. I was organizing a bird walk with the LGBTQ Staff Association. Spoiler alert, it would later be postponed to October, but that's what I remember trying to coordinate. And yeah, that's the first thing I think of as to what I was doing last year. What about you, Tony?
I was gearing up for summer camps, right? Mm-hmm. I work, you know, Parks and Recreation. I'm the director of an environmental center. So we were, you know, making sure we had our staff, making sure we had our supplies, making sure we had the lunches, you know, doing all that sort of work. And of course we're not having field trip summer camps this year. So it's very strange. I don't even know when I'm going back to my facility. Mm.
It's a lot of uncertainty out there, certainly. And I think this time last year, 1st of June, I had a brief break, but was coming off of, you know, for us as bird brains, May is, man, you hammer it in May, right? You're mm-hmm. all over the place following the birds, mm-hmm. doing your thing. And I was on a little bit of a respite, and my next stop was actually a writing workshop up in Middlebury, the Environmental Writers Workshop up there that I love dearly. So
in Vermont?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. My girlfriend went to that college.
Oh God. That place, Vermont, is special to me. And I always tell people it's one of the, the most homogenized sort of places that I've been. There wasn't a whole lot of diversity there, but I felt totally, yeah, it was very white. Mm-hmm. But I've from day one, when I went to a writing workshop at a little place called Sterling College up in the Northeast Kingdom, mm-hmm. I felt accepted. I felt very, I don't know, I felt at home in ways that I had not felt anywhere else, in part because nobody really knew me. And in this new life as a creative writer, I had license to just be me without, you know, having to sort of code switch back and forth between me and expected me. So yeah, I spent, you know, a few weeks of summer up in Wild Branch for 3 or 4 years. And then got the invitation to do a whole thinking retreat in Faceton, Vermont. So, you know, spent a week in a yurt doing vow of silence and really hard conversations about race and the environmental / conservation movement. And that taught me a lot. And then, you know, having the opportunity to go up to Middlebury and to teach in a writing workshop there under the direction of Megan Mayhew Bergman. Man, Vermont has been as responsible for my writing life as any place. And that's, for nature writers, I guess in some ways that's sort of, I got to taste a bit of the Mecca, but every time I would go, you know, I was going up there in the spare time between drafts that were due or some little session or the big workshops, I was out looking for birds. And I remember the persistent sound in bird sounds in Craftsbury Common were least flycatchers, so chibek, 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 and warbling vireos. If you see me, I will seize you and then squeeze you till you squirt. Just over and over and over again. But
could you just repeat that?
If I see you, I will squeeze you. If I see you, I will seize you and then squeeze you till you squirt. That's sort of the, I don't know. You might have to put like a rate or some sort of rating on that. That's the mnemonic that I learned for. I mean, if you think about it, if you try to say that really fast, you know, you sound.
If you say that really fast, you're selling records, okay? Actually, right. If you say that really fast.
So there you go. But you know what? Of course, all of us have our recording studios right in our hands. So I ought to just take that mnemonic and put it on like, you know, 78. And then you'd have something. But
you've just alienated all the millennials.
Oh, when I said 78? Oh, I'm sorry. If I bumped the speed up. Right. But I, you know, that was, birds were still, and I was writing about birds all the time. Every time I would write something, even if it was about racial injustice or, you know, climate change, some, you know, these issues writ large, you know, the big talk, so to speak, the birds, which not everybody up there was a birder, but, you know, there were people there like Chip Blake, who is the editor, recently retired editor in chief at Orion magazine, and Janice Ray and David Gessner, and, you know, people who I had admired their writing, but then to go birding with them and to have this totally different set of birds in between the big talk really sort of measured my days. So yeah, Vermont is a special place to me, always will be. And I record it to this day, and I'm still, the last time I went, I was still looking. So far, and I'm probably going to jinx this, somebody's going to send a picture. Once they hear this, somebody's going to send a picture. It was the only state where I had not encountered a Confederate battle flag. It was the only state. And wow. Yeah.
And for context, how many states have you been in general?
46 out of the 50.
Wow.
46 states. I'm missing North Dakota, Idaho, Hawaii. What's the other? No, so 47. Yeah, 47. Because I finally got to Utah a couple of years ago and spent a little bit of time there. But yeah, so that was something that I was checking out, right? That was because everywhere I go, I'm always super conscious of where I think I'll be safe, it's safe to bird, and where not. So, you know, that was, and in Vermont, I'm wandering down all these little dirt lanes and just walking and not really knowing necessarily where I'm going, and being from, you know, the South, where, you know, you just don't wander onto somebody else's property. In most places in the United States, you don't do that out West. Don't just wander onto somebody's property. You don't just wander into somebody's backyard as a Black man. That
absolutely not.
Bad things can happen.
Oh, listen. And, you know, I know I've been birding with Tony since I was a teenager, and we, you know, like I said, he was the education manager for the program that I was initially a student. I was later promoted, but he was still my supervisor and also the bird expert, you know, and so he would choose the places that we would bird. Right, Tony? And you would, I'm sure you would take some consideration into the cohort of students, the docents that we were working with, or that I was a part of as well, were all from West Philly, all young Black men and women that, you know, love nature and just wanted to have some adventure, you know, learn while we earn some money. But Tony, can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually, today we made a blog post. I wrote an article at Tyke's request for the Wildlife Observer Network, and it's called "White Birders Must Be Aware That We Expose Black Birders to Racist Incidents." And circling back to the Confederate battle flag, one of the incidents I mentioned in there is how we took a field trip with the program out to the Poconos, and in the parking lot of the Pocono Environmental Education Center, there is a car with a license plate, front license plate, with a Confederate battle flag. And I don't think most of the students had ever seen that before, because, you know, in Philly, it's at least in neighborhoods where the students in the program came from, they didn't see that in West Philly. And we also talk about in that article, the incident when we took the crew down to Cape May. And on the way there, we stop at a Wawa. And two of the guys come back on the bus, and I can hear them talking in the back, and they're obviously like taken back and upset and hurt. And I go back there, and I'm like, what happened? What's going on? And they said that the store manager was following them around and asked them if they were going to buy their, you know, what the items they had in their hands. So, you know, I'm like, well, I go in and I confront the manager in front of her employees, and she goes, well, they're stealing. And I'm like, you're a liar. I said it right in front of everybody. Like, you are a liar. And I was like, show me the tape. And she's like, I'm like, you just were following them because they're Black. And when I called you out on it, you doubled down and lied, just like that woman did in Central Park with Christian Cooper. She was in the wrong. And so white folks always have this trump card, you know, pun intended, that they can use, like, when they're in the wrong with people of color. And it's got me thinking about how, you know, we think we're like doing this great thing for these kids. We're taking them to a place they haven't been before. It's the best place to bird, maybe in the world. And we get there and the Cape May Bird Observatory welcomes them with open arms, banning demonstrations, hawk banding. They go with Richard Crossley to his house to see, you know, songbird banding. We have this great day, but in the back of our minds, they were exposed to this incident. And I asked them on the bus, I was like, has something like this ever happened to you before? And they said, no. And you might, and a lot of people, when I told the story, were like, well, that can't be. I mean, they're, you know, they're black. They have to be constantly like bombarded with, you know, racist incidents. And I'm like, well, yeah, there's a systemic racism, but when you live your life in West Philly, like a store clerk can't follow around every person of color in a city that's majority people of color. So, you know, so you take birders out of, you know, birders of color out of their, you know, the spaces they're used to being and put them into predominantly white spaces. And even if the birders are friendly, and we can get into that because, you know, some of the things they say, you know, tend to be clueless or callous or, but, for real. You know, you can't account for the, you know, the non-birders that, you know, the muggles you're going to encounter on the way, at a rest stop, at a gas station, you know, you never know.
Yeah, that's the range map thing, right? And I can't wait to see that article, Tony, because you know, that's one of the, man, I get a lot of questions. You know, we get questions. I'm sure Tyke gets the questions. What can I do? You know, as if we have some, there's no magic bullet question, but even that consideration. You know, because we've all, you know, I've been in groups for so long where somebody says, oh, come on, let's just go to such and such a place and look for this bird. Or let's go look at this bird in this person's backyard. It's at their feeder and they said it was okay. And even recently I had a good friend, a former student, really, really, really cool guy who's turned into like one of the best birders in South Carolina. And, you know, it's late in the migratory period and, you know, Connecticut warblers are showing up here and there. And, one shows up sure enough. And, he's got it pegged. At least the bird singing, you know, Connie's, man, you don't really ever get great looks at them. At least I haven't. And
that is, absolutely.
You know, they just show you pieces of themselves, unless they make some mistake thinking they are hidden and reveal their reality. But this bird he had pegged out in a creek behind this neighborhood. And, you know, and first I'm making assumptions about, I don't know anything about the neighborhood, but just in, you know, his email to me in this place of where this bird was, I, for a second, I was like, man, you know, I can go see that bird. I can be safely socially distanced, all that stuff. And then I thought, I was like, no, you can't. And I emailed him back. I said, you know, would you, you know, how about we hook up and go? And he wasn't able to. And so then there was never a thought in my mind that I was going to go and look for that bird. There was never a thought in my mind. If it had been 5 miles away instead of 35, I would not have gone into a neighborhood with binoculars. And you know how you got to look for Connecticut warblers, man. You got to skulk yourself. It's not like you just go busting up in there like it's a northern periola singing at the, you know, at the top of some big tree. They're in places where you got to sort of, you know, furtively find your way. So,
and you may have to actually flush them You know,
you may, and there you are, you know, you're out there. And, you know, I never told him unfairly. I should have said to him, you know, man, I appreciate the pig, but I can't go by myself. And the man, and that feels, I'm 55 years old. That feels odd to me to say, well, you know what? I can't go there. Then I think back to my parents, and they knew there were signs telling them where they, bluntly telling them where they couldn't go, where they weren't allowed. But when I see Confederate flags, and I remember a trip up to my first trip up to Hawk Mountain, one of my great, great, great friends, love this man, Dan Kunkel, who is at the Lehigh Gap Nature Center, had me up there. And Diana White Husick, who's a great champion for racial justice, and she's at Moravian College. And so they were hosting me, and I'm going up there. And I remember driving through what I assume were probably old coal mining towns or whatever on the way to Hawk Mountain. And I saw so many Confederate flags. I'm like, wait a minute, this is Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, we were invaded by the South. So don't give me that heritage, not hate bullshit.
For real, you know, but so Confederate flags, y'all. I'm also very cautious when I see too many don't tread on me flags, MAGA hats, and okay. Trump flags. I mean, I'm just being real.
We're picking out the field marks of an unsafe space for.
They are. Well, at least, you know, it, to me, I'm on a different alert.
You're on that B-bird alert?
Yeah, so. I am. You know, crest slightly raised. It's, you know, piloerection is a thing. Mm-hmm. That's a science term, y'all. Look it up, those listening. Piloerection, it means feather erection. It is a thing, and I'm glad that you've written towards it. And I see you guys sent me the link, so I'm looking forward to checking that out.
Absolutely. And on that tone, I think that this is, if I could use, you know, inspiration from the 9 new ones that you presented, this has been a revelation to some extent for folks, especially white folks who have identified where their allyship or not has been for the last couple years, when the incidents that we are seeing now have been evident in our existence prior. Delayed validation is still validation, but it's delayed. And, you know, I try to not get too cynical in that regard of that delayed validation. But I am definitely motivated that we can move to a better place in this.
That's the hope. You know, that, and, you know, the Black Birders Week and seeing a new generation, man, I suddenly feel very old, you know?
It's okay. I'm not going to lie. When you said 55, I was like, the AARP doesn't even know your name.
But they trust me. They do. They caught me at 48. They stalk you. Oh, Lord. They stalk you way out. But That's one of the satisfying. You talk about validation. A good friend of mine, Keenan Adams, who is my first, he was my first Black graduate student, and he now works. He's was on detail in Puerto Rico, but he is now in. He's still in Puerto Rico, but he did a lot of work with inclusion and diversity with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And he and I were talking about sort of the, you know, just the evolution of everything. And that this week is one of those validation of it. And hopefully that beyond the week and into coming years and decades and forevermore, that we're able to talk about conservation writ large, with bird watching, birding is a part of it, that this was a turning point, that people have something to positive to talk about in 2020, that the positive that they talk about in 2020 in part, you know, those who survived, you know, that there was some turn made in the justice system, that Black Birders Week, you know, is now in its, doesn't have to exist, because, you know, bird watching has become such a diverse and inclusive thing that, man, you know, it looks like the country, it looks like the nation, and mm-hmm. people can more freely go where they want to go. And that's the hope, and you guys are spearheading that. So thank you, really. That's what I wanted to get around to saying. Thank you for that.
That's very much appreciated. We, and when I say we, I'm speaking with the confidence of the Black AF in STEM organizing group that brought Black Birders Week. We are standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, that include your name and Edmund Dudley. And it is definitely something to be proud of, that we can still talk to each other. You know, we can still smell the roses together. We can still go out and watch birds together. Yeah. I mean, coronavirus, give or take, we can still enjoy what we enjoy together. And, you know, I've been saying this a lot, I'm going to say it again here. We didn't pick our moment, but we are going to rise to the occasion. And this has just been that moment. And, it's been a lot to digest, and honestly, I haven't really taken the time to emotionally digest everything. I've been really fulfilled with putting all of my energy into Black Birders Week. I don't know what is going to happen after this week. I don't really know how much time has really passed. I don't know if I've slept, but I know that this is very fulfilling. And I also appreciate you saying that, Drew. You know, the messages of support and the request of how can I help, you know, very meaningful and part of what motivates me into thinking that we're going to be in a better place. I mean, it's going to take some work and a lot of things are going to change. And that's something Tony and I was talking about yesterday, that the type of outcome that we're looking for is going to require a ridiculous amount of change. And by ridiculous, I don't mean bad ridiculous. I mean, like awesome. Like it's just going to take in a substantial amount of things to happen that will change for us to get that outcome. Hmm.
Yeah, that's, you know, thank you. That's the, you know, the goal is to illuminate always. I think, you know, you shine a light on something, and it does one of two things. Well, three, I can think of. It grows. Mm-hmm. It sits in the sun and melts and smolders, and which is not good. Or it runs away, as roaches do when they're exposed to light. And I know that this is neither of the latter two, that this is the first thing, that that exposing who we are, you know, these shared passions that we have with birders of every hue is a critical sort of thing to understand. But then understanding where culture converges with conservation and where it melds with our lives is important. I got a request working on an article now for Scientific American about barriers to being a Black natural scientist. And I think about what those barriers were. And unfortunately, those barriers weren't always presented by white people. They were sometimes presented by misguided perceptions of who we are supposed to be, even in our own communities.
Yes, yes.
You know, so that's just truth that has to be out, that we also can't be in our own way. You know,
we have to lift as we climb.
Yeah, right. You know, that guess what? No, you cannot take my Black card My Negro FICO does not go down because I watch birds.
Or are you sure it doesn't? It does. Would it go down if Joe Biden said it does? you may not go down because of birding, but if if the potential president of the United States says you ain't black, quote, does that mess up your black FICO score?
Well, you know what it does. That's a lesson. That's a real lesson of appropriation. And it's an example. Thank you, Senator Biden, Vice President Biden, for holding that up as a ready lesson to say, guess what? This you don't do. You don't define who people are. Mm-hmm. You know, and man, that, as my grandmother used to say, that flies all over me because it again, you have to put up with that for a lot of your life. I mean, you know, birders of any color who, you know, suffered the slings and arrows in school of not being cool or being called, at least back in my day, you know, being a nerd or mm-hmm. Being laughed at and really sort of having to closet what you did because you didn't want to be picked on. You know, that's something that has to be watched. And so that's, you know, that doesn't, I'm not saying that, you know, that I want to, you know, dig a hole and bury him in it because he said it. But I hope his advisors quickly, and I know he's made apologies for it, but you know, that's the same thing as saying, oh, you know, the people who's telling me, well, black people don't watch birds. Why would you want to go out there? Black people don't do that. You know, I had quite a few black people tell me that.
Oh no.
Yeah. I mean, so that's, you know, that's the other side of the impediment of there were people who said, well, why would you want to do that? Why don't you work this job to make a lot of money and then you can do that on the side? So you talk about delayed validation and gratification, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of the things that I want anybody to know, young or old, is that if you have a passion for something, if you have a passion for birds, if that's what you want to do, then, you know, then you follow that and you don't let other people define you, mm-hmm. define what you love or who you love. You know, the other side, you know, that racist side of barriers to sort of being a little further down the road, or when someone sees you pursuing that, they decide that they want to get in your way or worse. You know, that's a totally different set of circumstances that we have to deal with, you know, for the police to pull me over because, you know, they see me in a place and don't think that I belong there. You know, that's a totally different explanation of being than explaining to somebody, well, yeah, I do like watching birds. So, but I know we contend with both. Mm-hmm. And I think the former of it coming from your own is something that, you know, that's a matter of resolve and you can solve it. Pretty Absolutely. Easily. You just do it. Yeah.
That's almost exactly what Black Birders Week is about. You know, like yeah. You can't claim there are no black birders. You can't claim that birding isn't black. You can't claim that my interest in birds is somehow antithesis to my blackness. You know, and I even think that the idea of, you know, you're going into birds so that you can escape the reality that you're living in. It's like, no, I'm going into birds to engage with it.
Yeah. Nothing more.
And I had a very special way of doing that in Philly because we were very, you know, through that program, first thing we learned about was park history, you mm-hmm. know, and I think it will, on that topic, I think it will always be interesting, the history of our parks, you know, and the parks that we go to bird and the parks that we go to walk our dogs, you know, and what will be the history of Ramble Park. I don't know if this will always be the history. I don't think it should be, but when I'm going out to bird and, you know, we're going to a park, and you know, I always, if I can't research it, I always wonder, you know, what all happened here. You know, I know that I feel that I can be here right now, but what was it like maybe 5 years ago?
Well, that you have to ask those questions, right? You know, we learn, you know, we may ask different sets of questions. And that's, you know, one of the other conversations that I hope is enjoined is within bird watching, what is privilege? You know, Tony was talking about that earlier, and the privilege of just saying, oh, let's go see the bird here, and you come along, you'll be fine. You know, and eventually, hopefully sooner than later, I know some of the tiny bit of silver lining that you can find in this very dark cloud is that people are finally beginning to understand what privilege they possess. You know, and that's always a useful exercise for me. Even I, you know, I have to understand the privilege that I possess. You know, from an educational standpoint, from, you know, my socioeconomic situation now, you know, my access to green space.
Yeah.
Hell, being in my backyard like I am and having that green that I can kind of curry the, you know, the favor of and bring birds in, that's a privilege that everybody does not have. And so that exercise of privilege declaring is important, and it gets us to a different space. So, you know, bird watching for me is not a privilege. It's for me, it's my life, it's my livelihood. And if I had done something else, I tell people, if I had gone on in another year and year and a half, finished my degree in engineering, I think I would have been an okay engineer. But do you really want, you know, it's like that commercial. Do you just want okay engineers building airplanes and designing airplanes and building and designing bridges and things that are going to fall apart at the cost of human lives? No, you want the most passionate people doing their best jobs. So, you know, you want the most passionate people conserving lands and wildlife and bringing other people into those spaces. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a lifestyle for us. I think we would say, you know, I'm looking at my bird on Black Swan Bird Observatory hoodie now. And, you know, and that says that it's a lifestyle. Bird on, y'all. I added the y'all because, you know, I got to have that flavor.
I knew. The southern part is always going to come out just a little bit. And I know that the southern part of the U.S. is blessed with so many black birders. And that actually brings me to a question that I think you and Tony have a great opportunity to answer from your perspectives. Like, I'm only learning, you know, or I'm being introduced to a lot of new, or for me, a lot of black birders, and a lot of those folks are in the South, and, you know, birding with Tony, in Philly and in South Jersey, most of the birders that I interacted with were like punk rock stars and people that were like, oh yeah, I used to, you know, do a rock band with Tony. Now I run a co-op, or, you know, yeah, I'm getting my master's in biology, but I went to school for music. You know, it's just like the most eclectic people you can imagine. And I think that's a through line through all birders. But do you think that there's a difference in bird culture in the South, you know, South ways, the southern part of the U.S., and maybe to the northeastern part? You know, I don't know exactly where I can make that divide. I know that the birds are different, but is the bird culture different?
You know where the birding Mason-Dixon line is?
Oh yeah, I like that. What's that?
It's Cape May, to me. It's really Cape May is where I point, you know, in that whole sort of, and you can come, some people would come a little further down towards the real line, but I put, you know, the north-south dividing line there. And and birding pivots culture wise at Cape May. You know, I've talked a little to my to Dave LaPuma. You know, you guys know Dave, and great guy, and we would do these tours out in Wisconsin, take people through New Jersey Audubon out there, and you'd have a chance. You know, you'd have a bunch of folks on a van from mostly from, you know, New Jersey and New York, but you'd get them from other places too. Mm-hmm. And with all the bird tours that I've led and the festivals, you get to understand that there are differences regionally in how people bird, you know, what their expectations are, you know, just sort of how they go through a birding day. I could, man, you know, hardest core, man, you know, New York.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It just some, and when I say hardcore, I'm talking, you know, you got to be on it. You know, don't make quick wrong calls.
Interesting. On
birds, and you know,
are you talking about specifically via city or
the city?
Okay,
you know, and people are, you know, people are going to side eye you. If you've got one or two calls, maybe, to make those mistakes,
tough. But
not that really, you know, New Jersey is a little bit of a mix. You know, once you get down into the Southeast, mm-hmm. People are they're more laid back about birding. Not that they don't appreciate it, or can't be intense about it. But you're not likely to sort of get the same kind of side eye for a misidentification. You know, if you keep calling, you know, if people keep calling, I don't know, pileated woodpeckers ivory bills or something, of course, you know, you become persona non grata. Yeah. But it is different here. I think the most when I go out west, it's the intensity, you know, people grind, but not, to me, not in the same way that people grind in the Northeast. In the mm-hmm. Northeast up there, y'all grind, you know, sort of differently than people down here do. You know, somebody, you know, I know a couple of the, you know, the compilers, for eBird and some of the other folks for, you know, Christmas bird counts, that kind of stuff. And, you know, if there's a mistake on a list, you know, they call you up nicely or email you, you know, they'll lead people to help them understand why that, you know, that really wasn't a vermilion flycatcher that you probably saw in your backyard eating sunflower seeds. and it was probably a cardinal. You know, you go other play, man, you would get blasted, right? So I think part of what you see down here is really sort of a larger reflection of just sort of cultural mores, the way people go about life in different regions of the country. And one is not better than the other in a lot of instances, and some it is, but, you know, in this instances, it's just different. And you know, you have to look at where population centers are outside of cities. And, you know, it's a lot of rural black and brown folk down here who live close to nature, who depend on it in farming, hunting, fishing. And you know, I think about the Joe family down in the Black Belt of Alabama, where Jason and I did that Black Belt bird tour last year with the Joe family. And
I want to talk about that too. That's incredible. And I hope that there's an opportunity for you to maybe do it some way this year, next year. I just wanted to throw that in real quick, but please.
Yeah, I hope so.
I talk about the Black Belt. I teach plant ecology. I have an adjunct position at Temple. Uh-huh, so I talk uh-huh. about the Black Belt because it's I can show how a soil type not only determined the plant communities, but also the human communities. And I show them the black belt, and then I show them the voting map in 2016.
Yes.
And how it completely correlates.
I mean, so it's no gap, right? You know, that the range maps, it's no gaps. It's clear. And bird wise, you go there and you think you're in Kansas, right? You know, it's just such a cool place, but here's this, you know, this black farm family that's had land in their family for, I think, over 100 years. And raising beef cattle, but you know, we went down there to see swallowtail kites and Mississippi kites in their hay fields. And Mr. Joe, you know, delayed his haying to cut so that, you know, so the kites would come down and feed. And it was, man, we had a whole busload of people down there who got to see, you know, a different way of being. They got to see people who nobody talks about on the land, appreciating the land. So I think things like that are important because they show that we are limitless, you know, that we have loves and passions that flow in all sorts of different directions. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward, Tony and Tyke, to one day rejoining that whole deal, because that was one of the best Saturdays that I've spent in my birding life. And I honestly cannot tell you how many birds we ended up with on our list for the day. I can recount, you know, watching people thrilled at the, you know, the acrobatics, the aerobatics of Mississippi kites. And when the lone swallowtail kite made an appearance, just, you know, how gobsmacked people were. But I remember the people from that, you know. I remember, you know, meeting a good friend of mine now, Barry Fleming, who is an artist and naturalist and, man, writes some of the best bird poetry. So that's one of the things I want people hopefully to come away with, is that bird watching, birding, bird adoring, all of it is for, it is obviously for everyone, is John Robinson said a long time ago. But now, you know, with this week, there's evidence. You get to see it. You get to feel it. And hopefully you get to participate in it.
I want to say that there's a lot of ways folks can participate in Black Birders Week, even the white people. And Tony is a great example of that, where, you know, we did the Post a Bird on Monday. And I think everyone had an interesting bird and an interesting fact. I'm going to share mine and I'm going to ask you to. And I picked the starling, the European starling. I have this really great photo that I took of it in D.C. On the rooftop of an apartment. And it was nesting in the gutter just underneath that roof. But it was just sitting there, you know, and it would, like me, just sit there and just ponder about where we are today, where we've been, and the fact that we were both brought over on ships.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just here, you know? And I was just like, that's a revelation. Tony, why don't you share yours? What was yours?
Yeah, I shared the Hammer Cop. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because I was looking at the guidelines for the Black Birders Week, and for Post a Bird, it said bird you saw, I think, recently, or post a bird fact. And hammer cops make, you know, obscenely large nests. And I had been to Kenya just over a year ago, and on my belated honeymoon. And so I posted a picture of two hammer cops that I saw. But I made the point to say that the name had come from and I get the fact about the nest and that it took 8,000 sticks to make. And And then I made a point that, you know, Hammer Cop, the name is the Afrikaans word for hammerhead. And, you know, I said, you know, it's just the language from the Dutch invaders. You know, I wanted to not gloss over that part of the name, right? And then in the last couple months, I've become Facebook friends with every bird guide in Uganda and a few, and I don't know how that happened. I mean, literally, like, I'm at the point now where I'll get a bird request from a friend request, right? And I'll look at mutual friends. It'll be 100 some mutual friends, and all the other mutual friends are other Ugandan or like Ghanaian. Like, it seems like, I mean, it's been other countries too. I didn't go to Space Coast, but maybe somehow at Space Coast, some people were there, and it seemed like it coincided with that festival. And, you know, I'm friends with a lot of the bird guides that go there, and maybe they saw me, and I don't know why, but literally my Facebook friends have grown by like 700 since then. And it's all bird guides, mostly in Africa, but some in, like, you know, Central and South Asia. Mm-hmm. And so someone from Uganda was like, well, that's what we call them here. And I'm like, did I just get schooled? I'm not quite sure.
Wow. Drew, what was your bird? Did you do a bird for Pick a Bird?
No, I didn't, but I have a couple.
I could imagine.
But I, you know, Starling is actually one. I've been on this sort of thing, you know, about nativist language, but probably now the fascination lies deepest with loggerhead shrikes, because we share code switching lives. I mean, here's a passerine, a songbird that doesn't have, I love its song. It's sort of harsh, raspy, it's unmistakable really, but it's a songbird by every measure of what a songbird is, and number of primaries, and the arrangement of its feet, and its vocal, and its syrinx. It's a songbird, but then it's got to eat, right? And so it doesn't have raptor feet, but it's got this raptorial beak, and it impales its prey. And I hate it when people call them victims. It impales its prey on thorns and barbed wire and sharp sticks because its feet are not strong enough for it to grasp the prey and carry it. And so it will develop these larders, and it's a code switcher. And I think about how many of us go through life with one language, for example, or diction at work, and then we get home and we relax. You know, we not only take off our you know, proverbial coat, figurative coat and tie, and get comfortable in the way that we get comfortable, but then we also, our language loosens. You know, it's sort of the way you talk around your college friends or people you grew up with or your family even over the holidays versus the way you do when you're talking to, you know, members of the executive team. And so strikes are code switchers. And they've suffered because of that. Because of their raptorial nature, they didn't receive the same protection as most other songbirds early on. You look back at some of the old literature, which I love doing, and you know, they talk about not protecting certain hawks and shooting them, but also it talked about the injurious butcher bird, which is the colloquial name for loggerhead shrike. So loggerhead shrike.
Yeah, would be the bird. I definitely think that it would be worth, you know, going into another episode just about the language that we hear in documentaries when we see birds, and the difference between the language we hear when those birds are white and the difference when those birds are black, or when the bird is, like you said, you know, demonstrating predation, but it's characterized as you know, there's a victim involved with this thing that's happening. You know, I would love to capture that. And, you know, 'cause I'm sure that there are other birds that have, you know, in the, that you've wrote about already, Drew, that have that, you can talk about it. You can have that small talk, right, about the bird, yeah. The bird or small talk about the hooded warbler. Yeah. But in the same way, that's one of your revelations about how nobody questions why the hooded warbler wears the hood.
Yeah. I mean, that bird has a privilege that I don't. I mean, really, even in my own neighborhood, if I walk around with a hood on, there could be some suspicion there. People don't know who I am. Why is that guy walking around with a hood?
And you are over 6 feet tall. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that genetic benefit or disadvantage is, unfortunately, what can make you literally a bigger target.
Bigger target. Mm-hmm. So, hooded warbler can fit in the palm of your hand with some room left over. But I'm looking at a couple of my books, some of my older books, and as I write about these birds and sort of the cultural associations and how they cross over, I look at a bird that was once a poster child for conservation and the banning of DDT, the double-crested cormorant, that's become in many places public enemy number one. But when you look in Sprunt and Chamberlain, birds of South Carolina, the colloquial name for the double-crested cormorant is nigger goose. And it was called that because sometimes waterfowlers would make a mistake and kill one, but it was worthless to them because, I mean, they're piscivorous birds and, fish-eating birds don't taste very good. And so they would just let it lie. But now you see where people are getting licenses to just kill double-crested cormorants because they're perceived to have negative impacts on fisheries, even put-and-take fisheries, right? Fish that don't belong, but because the cormorants are quote unquote stealing fish from the fishermen.
Yeah. Right.
These big black birds stealing mm-hmm. fish from the fishermen. You got to kill them. So, those are the kinds of things that to me, as we were saying before, there's, as Tony was talking about, the black belt and range maps and, vegetation determining where, not only where people are, but then ultimately how, things get gerrymandered and how political power is taken away. And you can trace that back literally to roots in the ground. You can trace it back to soil, and man, That to me is one of the amazing things about birds and why it's difficult for me to watch birds without thinking about, who they are as well as what they are.
Yeah. I like to, I don't know what it means to say when things calm down. When we feel like we can entertain talking about other things, I know you are a huge collector of bobwhite memorabilia, is that correct?
Yeah, man.
So we do another on this network, we do another show called the Nature's Hype Man, and that's with Robin Irizarry. And love to have you on and talk about bobwhites and your collection and love of them. And also, if you like this platform, holler at us. Maybe we, get you your own show or something.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean that would be awesome. I mean, listen, man, this is Tony. This is something that Tony and I and a couple of friends from Philly started, and it's just been something that, it's just been kind of do it yourself, and we've been figuring it out, working together, and having fun, and this just something to think about for you.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on, and I appreciate your courage. I appreciate your willingness to step out and put yourselves out to let others speak and to speak to issues that that aren't always easy to speak to. So I'm really proud to be a part of it. So thanks.
Black Birders Week. We'll have Drew on Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern time to discuss in depth and very candidly birding while black. And it is something that is especially exciting because we also have a panel that day in the afternoon with Chris Cooper. You know, again, we have this opportunity in this week to highlight, promote, and celebrate black birders. You know, even though we know we're doing this, you know, in a very critical moment in our history, in a very critical moment for black people. And, you know, I'm definitely proud that I can be a part of that. And I think that what we're doing here and what we need to be doing is going to reflect how the future generations will see us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. And the usual, everybody, if you want to like this podcast, please like and subscribe to the Wildlife Observer Network feed on your podcasting platform of choice. It will probably make its way eventually to YouTube too. And if you're hearing us on YouTube, please like and subscribe as well and share. Thank you, Drew. And of course, thank you, Tyke.